Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday morning, the 4th of June, and it's been a lot of fun here in the studio catching up with our panelists who are here, or most of them are in here in the studio. We'll get to that in a second, but it's nice to have everybody back. And as I said yesterday, it's all these different iterations of our panel and getting the groups back in order, and everyone's vaccinated and ready, and it's really been nice after doing it remotely for so long. With that said, we welcome everyone to the program. We're glad that you're spending time with us, and we're glad to be spending time with you. It is Friday, the 4th of June, 15 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We welcome your letters, as always. If you'd like to get in and discuss any of the stuff we're talking about, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Yo, Joe, I'm fine. I was listening to the lovely, as Lawrence Welk used to say, the lovely music.
That's right. Yeah. Weirdly, that's exactly what David Soares just said. That's the exact words that just came out of his mouth. Yeah. But
lovely music.
I don't know. He was listening to it and then likened it to his heart operation. David Soares is here. He is Albany County's district attorney. Good morning, sir. How are you?
You guys didn't know there was like a cardiovascular surgery like soundtrack? You didn't know that?
It's to calm you down.
Yes.
It's to keep you, you know, keep you in tune and maybe get you ready for heaven. I don't know.
It sounded more spa, you know, like a massage.
I just want to, you know, props out to the DJ at St. Peter's that played that track when I was getting my surgery.
We are also pleased joining us via Opal Technology, which if you don't know what that is, we don't expect you to, but it is a technology, an app-based technology that allows us to make it seem like Judith Henke is in the studio.
Well, we should say sometimes allows.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It can be a little persnickety.
Temperamental.
But senior fellow and visiting professor of Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Henke, good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Good morning. I'm sorry not to be there in the studio because I wanted to do my inspection of David Soares's beverage choice. I trust there was no slippage during the last year and a half. No plastic straws, no polystyrene cups. Everything good, David?
David came in sans beverage.
Everything is in my car. There was a metal straw.
Yeah,
metal
straw.
The one I gave you?
Yes, metal straw. That's how
wow.
I
good for you.
That is.
That really makes me happy. Thank you.
I'm afraid of environmentalists with the length of the kind of title she has coming after me.
Yeah, you don't need that.
It's just a lot to report on a 911 call. Now I got to add via Opal.
Yeah. And that's true. I'm glad that was all worked out. You have been absolved of your sin. Aaron Pasitti is here. He is I want to say you're the economics professor at Siena College, but I assume there are others.
There are.
Okay. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to be back. I forgot how decadent the green room is.
Yeah.
With the music going.
Yeah, it's really good.
Pastries are on point today.
That's right. Exactly. Full. It's always catered. Bar. Mm-hmm. Everything.
Cappuccino machine working okay.
Perfect.
All those pastries.
Oh, yeah,
sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Alan. By the way, Joe, I was watching CNN, which announced that Trump was now asking his advisors if he could be reinstated as president. Talk about creeping fascism. Here we go.
Yeah. I think it's funny that you have to ask.
Yeah. Well,
hey, David, can I steal the election and become president?
It's like we're all having to deal with the fact that we elected him. Like, this man is insane and he's only been removed from office several months, and
the orangutan's out of the bag.
We elected that guy.
God.
Say I did not. You said we, but
well,
I
mean, we as the American people.
The American people.
We as the voters of this country and the majority. Well, not even the majority. He didn't win the popular vote, but still,
no.
The electoral majority. a lot of asterisks behind that. Well, good morning, everybody. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's talk about something equally exciting, and that is the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. Is it Louis or Louis? Do we know?
I call him Louis.
Yeah. Well, I know you do. But Louis DeJoy, in connection with they're investigating for past political fundraising. The FBI is investigating DeJoy in connection with campaign fundraising actively involving his former business, according to people familiar with the matter, as well as a spokesman for DeJoy. FBI agents in recent weeks interviewed current and former employees of DeJoy in the business, asking questions about political contributions and company activities, these people said. Prosecutors also issued a subpoena to DeJoy himself for information. That person, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity. Mark Corallo, a DeJoy spokesman, confirmed the investigation in a statement, but insisted DeJoy had not knowingly violated any laws. Mr. DeJoy has learned that the Department of Justice is investigating campaign contributions made by employees who worked for him when he was in the private sector. He has always been scrupulous in his adherence to the campaign contribution laws and has never knowingly violated them. Alan.
Well, first of all, I want to mention, and I think David would probably agree with me, that that he comes from Mudville, right? There is no joy in Mudville. I thought I mentioned that. You know, the idea that I didn't know the gun was loaded, I'm so, so sorry, my friend. Maybe I did it, but I didn't know what I was doing when I did that. And as district attorney, David, you must hear a good deal of that, right?
You do. And then the evidence is right there to contradict the claim that you didn't know what you were doing. Because more often than not, first of all, these are what we would call historical cases. In other words, the acts have already been done and you have, you know, evidence of those acts already having taken place. And so what you'll see are, coincidentally, maximum contributions coming from a variety of different employees. What you'll also see is that those same employees have never made maximum contributions to other candidates, which are all, you know, evidence that would tend to support, you know, the scheme that Mr. DeJoy, who, by the way, looks like every single villain in every single movie I've ever watched involving like a nasty coach on the other side,
right,
screaming.
Usually on Lifetime or yes, occasionally Hallmark, but the evil boss who's going to come in and close down the factory 3 days before Christmas.
Absolutely, there's that guy. But going back to the premise, your premise, Alan, and that is, the evidence that is out there that is going to establish this case against Mr. DeJoy, it's already there, and there's nothing you can do to erase that. The other thing that investigators will also look to pursue is perhaps a tax case against those people who made these contributions, because I'm sure some of these people will not be able to demonstrate that, in fact, they claimed the dollars that were going out of their accounts, and the contributions that we're talking about here are in the millions of dollars. So the case against Mr. DeJoy, I will say, has already been built.
One of the things
I was just going to say, I'm sorry, Joe, that David, one other sort of district attorney question is, the clock is running, right, in terms of how long before this case goes away because it's been out there too long.
Well, the reason why I think you're hearing about it now and dealing with it now is because the investigators have a sense of what that time frame is. While I'm not so sure as to the statute of limitations on election fraud cases, whether that time would start to tick from the last contribution or the first contribution, depending on the theory of their case. If it's a scheme, then certainly we can look to, you know, his last involvement in activities.
Now, Judith Henk, I'm going to go to you on this because I think we have talked about this before, but this is one of those stories that we knew about, right? When DeJoy was named we talked about how there were disturbances in the force in his last job and concerns over the nature of his fundraising activities even before he got the gig.
Correct. I mean, this has been known for quite a long time. And I think former Attorney General Bill Barr just decided to turn a blind eye. So the new political leadership at Department of Justice accelerated this. I mean, I think there was an open case, but there was no real action on this. I saw the Washington Post reporter interviewed yesterday who has been on this story for, you know, well over a year or two. And he said what was striking was he would just cold call some of these employees of Mr. DeJoy. And just to recap, the allegation is that DeJoy or his associates would tell employees to make the maximum donation or a donation to various Republican candidates, and then they would get reimbursed for the donation, which is a clear violation of election law. Apparently, these employees were not very happy that they were told to do this, and they are talking extensively and freely, you know, just like one phone call, hi, I'm so-and-so from the Washington Post, and it's like the guy or the gal have been waiting for years to tell the story. So they have a very, very strong case. And I think that's why the poor press spokesperson for DeJoy keeps inserting the word knowingly. That word is doing a lot of work here. So, you know, you can't link these allegations to the horrible tenure at the Postal Service of DeJoy. But, you know, if it's going to, David knows better than anyone how long a case like this would take. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice if this guy just exited stage right and we can restore the Postal Service to the public service that we need it all to be, as opposed to his attempts to privatize and really, really damage that agency.
Aaron?
I think there's another interesting side to this story. So you have DeJoy, who runs a logistics company that's a contractor for the Postal Service. He's got no experience in government. He was a major donor to the Trump campaign. It's clear that he solicited contributions from his employees, and then ends up in a major government post. That revolving door between Washington and the private sector, I think, is made as explicit as possible with this case. You know, you help me get elected, I'll help you, you know, improve your stature, help your business prospects, and so on. And, you know, that's a cycle that's tough to break when you have a revolving door between wealthy individuals in the private sector who help politicians get elected, who help those wealthy individuals become wealthier through their policies. So it would be nice to see this cycle broken and, you know, convicting him of campaign funding violations would be a huge step in the right direction.
The other thing that, and Judith mentioned it in quoting the response from the press secretary for Mr. DeJoy, you know, that word knowingly, I'm pretty sure that that is part of the elements of the crime that the prosecution must establish, that he knowingly did what he did. And so injecting that into the response, although it sounds odd for us to hear, they're already beginning to flex, you know, their defense of Mr. DeJoy in this case by putting that out there in hopes that it will influence prospective jurors.
All right, we're going to take a break. We need to break, and when we come back, we'll continue discussion. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. So nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. We have with us Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Bassitti, and David Soares, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We got a couple on this. Michael says, awaiting the panel's excuses of why Mr. DeJoy is still in his position as postmaster.
My understanding is that the board of the Postal Service elects their postmaster general for an indefinite time period. So it's not a direct appointment like, say, the Treasury Secretary.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Correct. And the membership of that board has recently changed, right, and they will be taking action. And I do agree with the Biden administration of not coming in and just lopping off all of the heads of these agencies, because then it will look as political as his predecessors in appointing those individuals.
We get this from James DeJoy is just another name from Trump's Rolodex of associates who are as corrupt and morally bankrupt as he is. Trump has no friends, just associates, and they are all indicted or under investigation.
That's true, which means that at some point they will all be sharing the same condominium in some federal facility in the country.
Maybe.
I was just thinking of this recently. A whole bunch of them will likely share cell block 7 at Club Fed. But, after Watergate, Congress adopted a number of important reform laws to clean up our political process. And we're not seeing any of that in the aftermath of the Trump administration. Obviously, Mitch McConnell, who can't even muster the ability to support a reasonable infrastructure bill, is going to stand in the way of that. But what a missed opportunity. You know, we talk about the Watergate reforms. Are we ever going to have the Trump administration reforms so you don't have this, you know, horrendous ethical circus going on at the federal level?
I just don't see that on the horizon, given the fact that this man's ideology and the culture of Trumpism is so pervasive in the Republican, you know, party bloodstream. Right. I just don't see it. And yep, it's gotten worse at the local level, which should never have happened.
The one positive thing that the Trump administration did is bring egregious violations like this to the forefront. You know, before with, you know, Bush and, you know, Reagan, like, they had their cronies, but they were these, you know, they were lurking in the shadows, and it was a little more subtle. The fact that it was so outrageous in terms of who Trump appointed, how he governed, how his administration governed, just made it as clear as day that, like, this is a corrupt system, and it's not just the Trump administration. I mean, at this point, it's a large segment of the Republican Party.
Alan?
Yes. I mean, that's correct. This guy is so scary and so outrageous that he has within him the makings of American fascism, and we know it. It is so far outside the pole, I have no idea what to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone from gentle flirtation with fascism, you know, four years ago, and now we're like the Republican Party's on second base with fascism.
Let's take it over without an election. It's unbelievable.
It really is. Let's go to this letter from Lisa. When asked by Congress if he had done this straw donating, he emphatically said no. Isn't that an issue as well, David?
Oh, right. Yes. Testifying under oath and denying. And it wasn't just like...
But he didn't do it knowingly.
I can't remember. I don't recall. It was a straight-up denial. And then he challenged, you know, the assembly, the senator that was questioning him. He challenged him. You know, I'm offended. Like, well, that was all that needed to be done, because the FBI had been watching that hearing, and that's it. Like, here you go. Let's begin our investigation.
Norm says this donation scam was mentioned before the election when DeJoy was removing mailboxes and sorting machines, which I think we did mention. Why does it take this long to take this to court? Well, you have a different FBI, right?
You have a different Department of Justice. You know, I think one of the most remarkable things I heard here today, I think, was Judith saying that Bill Barr turned a blind eye. I didn't realize Bill Barr could see, because he saw no crimes like during his entire time, and neither did Mr. Sessions. But again, this is a testament to the career investigators and prosecutors at the DOJ who witnessed all of this in person, labored under this for the last 4 years, but didn't forget. And you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt means that you have to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt, which requires intense investigations, dotting of all I's, crossing of all T's. It's not the kind of thing you can put in a microwave, you know, and have an indictment in 3 minutes.
You know, yeah, I think it's important.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to point out the process. You know, there's an investigation, probably led by the FBI, and maybe they have partners in other agencies like the Elections Commission and state and local governments. And then the Department of Justice has a very robust public corruption unit. They're very, very effective. And the fact that we're hearing about this now, has visibility, you know, I think we should expect to see some action on this very soon. And I just think listeners need to understand that Bill Barr and the Trump administration really embraced lawlessness across the board. They didn't prosecute environmental crimes. They didn't prosecute government corruption crimes. And, you know, there's a big difference between DOJ today and DOJ under Bill Barr. And, you know, the writer who said, why is this taking so long? It's because Trump didn't believe in the rule of law when he was in office. So it's, you know, it's only June.
And very briefly, Judith, I think there's an element here that we're all overlooking. And that is the fact that Bill Barr, when the Mueller report had come out, this man, you know, couldn't wait to jump in front of a mm-hmm. microphone and really cloud what that report had said. So, you know, from that, you have to understand that there has been a culture in the DOJ over the last 4 years of certain memos that have been drafted on investigations that were total fabrications. So in addition to investigating the cases in front of them right now, they also have to go back and sort of disprove and explain, you know, some of those, you know, memos that were drafted in an effort to cover up some of these crimes. So it's not the typical investigation, you know, grand jury appearance and then sudden indictment. I'm sure there's twice the amount of work because of having to clean up after the former both Sessions and the clown in between and Barr.
Alan?
I keep thinking about the Mueller report. Don't you, gang? You know, the idea that this guy, Mueller, was supposed to be sort of the savior of the system and hold Trump accountable. Now, I just read in the paper that he's going to be teaching a course on his investigation. I would like to be in that room and raise my hand a couple of times. I mean, I have to say, the silence coming from Mueller after there was so much in that report that could have been led to indictments and other things, but nothing, just silence. Now, the other thing I'm thinking lately is I wonder how the Democrats are going to approach the 22 election. It seems to me that there's so much from the joy and all and the corruption and everything else that could be said that an ad, a nationwide ad saying democracy is at stake here, really ought to be out there. But we don't do our politics nationally that way. The Democratic National Committee doesn't, usually. They usually solidify on one person running in one race. So both of those are Mueller and also the way the Democrats conduct themselves. Otherwise, they're going to lose both houses of Congress.
I don't think a lot of the country's elite and a lot of voters really care about democracy. Like, maybe there's a threshold like January 6th, where it's like, all right, that's kind of pushing the boundaries. But, you know, in terms of appealing to, you know, democratic norms and the rule of law, I think a lot of the donor class really doesn't care about it. They just want their way, and they're willing to tolerate and hold their nose and close their eyes to whatever collateral damage might happen.
Which is how Hitler became
chancellor.
You are right, of course, but one hopes you're wrong.
I would love to be wrong on this.
One more letter before we go to a break. Linda says, is there anything being done to rein in the appointment of, quote unquote, acting temporary agency heads? It seems there should be a time limit on how long a person can hold an office without confirmation by the Senate. 45 had all acting, some would say play acting, as agency heads.
There is a time limit. It's in federal law. You can only act for particular periods of time for different offices. It's usually about 6 months. And then during the Trump administration, they just decided to ignore, once again, the law. And no one did anything to hold them accountable. But for people who are acting now during the Biden administration, it's likely because they're probably the number two or the number three at the agency, usually a career person waiting for the Senate to confirm the political appointment.
I also think you can't ignore the fact that there was no transition with the previous administration and the current administration. And so a lot of those jobs that were going to be filled, that delay in the transition has caused incredible delay with Senate confirmation as well.
Yes.
On that note, we'll pause. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll talk a little bit about infrastructure when we return. We welcome your thoughts on that. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. We are thrilled to be with you and to have you with us. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. Let's move on. As I mentioned, we wanted to address the issue of infrastructure, and are we close to a deal? President Biden narrowing infrastructure request, but hurdles remain for a bipartisan deal. The president offered new concessions this week, including dropping his plan to reverse some of the 2017 tax cuts as he tries to win support from Senate Republicans. A deal still appears to be a long shot, with potential tax increases the biggest hurdle to winning the kind of Republican support that Mr. Biden has said he is seeking. But the continued movement underscored his hopes for a revival of bipartisanship. The talks are being sustained by a desire among lawmakers in both parties to reach agreement over what has been a long-standing but elusive goal in Congress, repairing and enhancing the country's network of roads, bridges, water pipes, and other physical infrastructure. Both sides are trying to win favor with the moderate congressional Democrats, particularly in the Senate, who will ultimately decide the fate of the president's $4 trillion economic agenda. So, with that word economic, we'll go to Aaron. But before we do, Alan, your thoughts.
Well, no, you know, we know who they are. They come from the land of no. They're scared to death of for want of a better term, of the past president, Trump. No matter what Biden puts on the table to get their acquiescence so that we can have a sensible rule here, they say no. And they're going to keep saying no. He lowers it. They say not enough. They just are not going to go along with this. It's political. It's not nearly economical as many of us would hope. So that's what it's all about. And they will keep doing what they're doing, period.
This is absolutely political. It is not economic because what they're talking about.
Don't tell Aaron that.
Well, I'm trying to take some time here so he can get in his glasses on and put on his material, because we're talking about job numbers today, right?
Yeah, he'll have his moment, yeah. But go ahead.
The Republicans cannot do anything that will be interpreted as a victory for the Democratic Party, and that's what this is about. And so the only two people that don't know this on planet Earth is Kristen Sinema and my man Joe from West Virginia.
Yeah. for the past 25 years, Republicans have not been interested in bipartisan compromise on anything.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Biden could have a $200 billion infrastructure plan, something that's, you know, a tenth of the original size, and Republicans would be opposed to it for some other different set of reasons, whether it's the tax increases to help fund it, whether it's the scale of the spending, whether it's the scope of what it attempts to solve. I think Biden is barking up the wrong tree in trying to reach some type of compromise with Republicans. They're just not going to compromise on anything, period, because the goal is to get Biden out and get a Republican back in the White House. And I think there's a larger issue at play here, and that is the modern Republican Party has built itself on the basis that government is inefficient. Anything the government does is just going to make things worse. I think what they're facing is, well, the country needs a reboot of its infrastructure to the tune of $4 trillion. And they're scared to see that the government might actually do something that benefits the population and is actually effective. And I think Biden has a lot of leverage in terms of his two big moonshot bills, the infrastructure bill and the American Families Plan, of saying, look, the government can make people's lives a little bit easier. They can make our infrastructure represent that of the wealthiest country in the history of humanity.
Judith.
Yes, but
go ahead.
Well, yes, but doesn't Biden to some degree make out here? And the reason I say that is people aren't stupid. They're going to see who's objecting to this. They know what their needs are. It's why the Republicans are going hum now, because they know they're between a rock and a hard place. So even if he doesn't get what he wants, which he should, there will be some political benefits to the Democrats.
I don't know about that.
I'm not placing my faith in the intelligence of the masses anymore, not after this past year and the pandemic. The reality is the world is the world. Your world is dependent upon the media ecology that you subscribe to. And there's just a lot of people out there who continue to be influenced by misinformation. That's too much of a gamble for the president of the United States to gamble on. I'm just wondering when it gets to the point where Joe Manchin comes to the White House and President Biden says, look, I'm going to offer you a cabinet level position. So, you know, if you lose your election, you know, you will be okay. And the same for Kristen Sinema, who doesn't obviously understand history as well and continues to take this defiant, you know, position that we can achieve bipartisanship when there's been no evidence to suggest that it is possible under this climate.
Well, I think that that's an interesting concept, David. But I think Manchin really believes that you have to gut the most important provisions of crucial bills in order to be able to call it bipartisan. And I think that the Biden administration is making a very important strategic mistake here. Biden is very high in the polls. I think people are grateful that American politics is not a psychodrama every day, and that the Biden administration is competent, as we see with the vaccine rollout. He established a deadline. He said, and people thought Memorial Day was too generous, but he said, if there's no deal by Memorial Day, he's going to go his own way. That's a song. there was no deal by Memorial Day. And I think it's fairly obvious what Biden can do. He has the power of the presidency. Early on, he said there were four cabinet members that were going to go out and sell the stimulus package to the American public. A lot of these projects are what they're called shovel ready. So, you know, there's a bridge that's collapsing. There's a subway line in New York City that breaks down constantly. A tunnel needs to be built. A drinking water system needs to be upgraded. a sewage treatment plant is sending raw sewage into the Hudson River every time it rains. I'm not making that up. That happens all the time when it rains with the Hudson River. So it's really not that hard. You make your list of projects that are going to get funded, and you go congressional district by congressional district, and you go and sell it. You have to be aggressive. You cannot be passive. And Memorial Day has passed. So let's, you know, let's get out there and explain to people the benefit. You know, you hear infrastructure package and your eyes glaze over. You know, not everyone is hanging on every last paragraph in Politico, but you go out and you say, you know, the bridge you go over every day is ranked F by structural engineers. Might it be a good idea to fix it? I think you have to go out and sell it. And I hope that's what we're going to see now from the Biden administration. Otherwise, you know, nothing is going to pass.
Yeah, I mean, so I think Judith identified just the critical public safety, public health, economic justice aspect of infrastructure. Now, all of a sudden, Republicans are interested in infrastructure. Well, they had 4 years, you know, it was 4 years of infrastructure week. That just blew by, and all they passed was a $1.5 trillion tax cut. So to think that Republicans are actually interested in improving the country's infrastructure, I think, is a laughable concept, because they had 4 years to do anything, and they did nothing.
There's plenty of examples that support exactly what Judith is talking about, and for whatever reason, we're choosing not to focus on them. I mean— it wasn't that long ago that we saw children in Detroit, you know, being poisoned by the very water that they were drinking. It wasn't that long ago that we just experienced a power outage in Texas, of all places, that, you know, people died because they froze in their homes. And so this issue of infrastructure, it isn't an abstract issue. We're experiencing it every single day in different parts of the country. And I do think that the Democrats are negotiating against themselves. Why would you be, you know, reducing the tax rate on corporations and conveying that as an offer to the Republicans when they have no intentions of acting on any of those things?
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other items to discuss. We have a great panel to do it with. Alan Chartok, Judith Thank, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. We will continue our conversation. First, we have a brief break and news with Mr. Rigraff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Thank, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares making up the group this morning. We always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have many letters. Let me get to them here, and then we'll move. Does that make sense? Yeah, is that grammatically correct? All right, we'll get to them right now. And then we'll move on to other topics. Philip writes, the American public is not smart. How can you watch Trump supporters and say the public is smart? Please stop the Pollyanna nonsense.
I don't think they're not smart. I just think they have a different set of values that conflicts with what many other people believe.
I think that could be a bumper sticker. Please stop the Pollyanna nonsense.
I think it's one of the few times we've been accused of being Pollyanna-ish. Yeah, usually that, you know, we're the sky is falling. But okay. David says the GOP cannot let Biden make people happier. It would destroy two of their myths by proving government can fix problems and create jobs at the same time. Speaking of jobs, Aaron.
Yeah, this is the first Friday of every month is something I look forward to, not because it's Friday, but that's when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases its monthly employment report. So this morning, they released the—
Can I interrupt you real quick?
Sure.
The other day, I said to Mike, I said, do I have time to go to the bathroom before this next segment? And he said, you don't. And I said, oh, okay, I'll wait. And then he said, but— if next time, if you just ask Aaron about the jobs report, you'll have time to go in, do what you need to do, and come back. And I thought, well, that he's right. That's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll see you in a few minutes. But go ahead.
Yes, everybody, sit down, relax, grab a cup of coffee. I'll be here until 1:30. So the unemployment rate dropped from 6.1 to 5.8%. The U.S. economy added 559,000 jobs in May, which is double what it added in April. So it was a good report. It was a little shy of expectations. Good, but not great. We still have over 9 million unemployed workers. And at the current rate of job creation, so if we add 500,000 jobs a month, it won't be until November 2022 that we get back to where we were before the pandemic started. So there's still going to be a very long and very bumpy road in terms of getting the labor market, creating jobs back to where it was in February 2020. Most of the job gains came in leisure and hospitality. That was about half of all of the job gains. Obviously, the sector that lost the most jobs when the pandemic started is experiencing the fastest rebound. There's still 3 million workers that are just out of the labor force. You know, they had a job, and they're not even looking for work anymore. They're not classified as unemployed because they're not actively searching for work. So, you know, we've got 12 million people who presumably want to work, but just for a variety of reasons aren't working. You know, and that gets back to – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That variety of reasons that you mentioned, Aaron – you know, I mean, you cannot walk past a store in Great Barrington that doesn't have a help wanted sign in it. And I know you've addressed this before, but, you know, everybody poo-poos the unemployment question. But it seems to me there may be something there.
There is. A $20 trillion economy with, a labor force of, over 150 million workers can't just reboot a year's worth of lost economic activity in a couple months. That's going to take time. There's going to be a lot of frictions associated with it. So a lot of jobs are going to go unfilled. And the reason why you see a lot of unfilled jobs has to do with, like I said, a variety of factors. Workers who don't have access to affordable child care. Workers who have health concerns. Workers who are gaming the unemployment insurance system and are willing to not take jobs because they're getting as much or nearly as much as they would from unemployment insurance. And then there's another group of workers that perhaps want to work remotely, but but can't find remote work options. And then I think there's another category that I really want this to be true, that maybe some workers are recalibrating their priorities. Perhaps the pandemic has made it so that some families say, well, you know, we had two incomes before this started, and we can really get by on one income, so, you know, a second member of the household doesn't have to work. Maybe workers are becoming choosier in the types of jobs they accept and just aren't willing to take, you know, a $15 an hour job with no benefits. So there's going to be bumps. There's going to be, like I said, frictions, and this is probably going to persist for a long time, and it's going to be bumpy and it's going to be ugly, but, you know, that's what happens when you try to lift an economy out of a years-long coma.
Well, what should Biden do? Should he say, come on, folks, you know, or should he deal with the unemployment, you know, benefits in order to get people to go back to work?
Can I just say something here that I don't want to seem Pollyannish here, but
no.
And this is the first time on record in 51 years I've ever used the word Pollyannish. I may lose all my street credibility now for using that word. But, you know, I think we just have to take a real deep breath here and not read too much into these indicators that we've seen over the course of the last 2 months. Because if you're looking at this and if you're looking at these numbers – And you're just conducting your normal analysis, there's an assumption that all other parts of our economy and our society are functioning well. And I only look to my own example in my workplace, and I think of all of the parents that have lost, you know, childcare, at and they're still working on trying to build, you know, that support infrastructure for their own families. I look at the number of people who, you know, I work with that have experienced health, you know, issues that quite frankly were not there before, that are delaying their return. And so I anticipate that all of these things in the course of the next 6 months will sort of stabilize, because this idea that now we have vaccines and, boy, we've got a lot of people that are vaccinated and we can open up, we can have dinner. There's not a snap of the finger that's going to, you know, make our economy just return to what it was in 2019.
That's absolutely right. And let's remember, 600,000 Americans died from COVID. Many are sick. And while vaccine is going in the right direction, we have about 12 states that are at about 70% vaccination rate. But on average for the whole country, we're still just under half of the eligible people for vaccines actually have it.
So, when do we get the beer?
Yeah, I think in July.
July 4th, if we hit 70%, right? Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, there's the perception that things are back to normal, but for a lot of people, it's not. And school is just letting out this month. There's still so many heroic teachers and frazzled parents who are still doing Zoom school for another week or two. And, you know, there are health consequences to right. what the world is still going through. And, you know, if you want to look globally, there are still many, many countries that have very, very low vaccine rates. So this is typically American, where there's the expectation that, okay, you know, my family and I are vaccinated, so the economy is going to bounce back within 2 weeks. And I think Aaron points out wisely that this is all going to take some time. I mean, this was a seismic jolt to our economy and our whole society over the last year and a half.
One of the things that was brought up in a story on Marketplace right before our program that I thought was interesting, that I wanted your perspective on, Aaron, is that this idea, to Alan's point about of so many places looking for employees, that one of the things that we're seeing in these numbers is incentives that are being given, either higher wages or other incentives that are being given. So if that works, do you see that expanding?
Yeah. I mean, so.
And how much can you do and still, you know,
right.
Make it work?
You know, firms offering signing bonuses, firms offering higher wages. I mean, that's great for workers. But if there was a legitimate shortage of workers relative to the number of job openings, you would see an increase in workers' wages. You would see an increase in the average amount of hours that currently employed workers are working, and you would see an increase in the number a decrease in the number of workers working part-time as they get elevated to full-time status. You don't see any of that in any of the employment reports going back to last March. So businesses say they want to hire. That's very different than them actually being willing to hire. Right. I say I want to be a millionaire, but I'm not willing to put in the work to get to that level. Right. That there's a big distinction between that. So
that wasn't part of your proposal to your wife, was it?
I assume just the minute he said I'm going to be a college professor, it was just implied. Right.
Thanks, Allison. Yeah. Businesses saying they want to hire and then doing what is necessary to actually attract workers is a very different story. I think a lot of businesses are still stuck in the 2019 mindset, which is, well, we can pay whatever. People should just be happy to have a job. We'll pay the lowest wage we can. Yeah, it's a different game now. Workers are in short supply. Some workers might not be interested in switching firms. Some workers might have gotten perfectly okay with having a one-income household. So I think it's a very different game, and I think businesses are the ones who are being slow to adjust.
Some letters on this. We go to Paul. Even if a person feels that their place of work may be safe, many people have to depend on public transportation, which may be less safe. Irene says, I love when Aaron talks about the current economic situation. I certainly need to be reminded and educated about the way the economy is driving important societal decisions. Thank you, Aaron.
See? Hear, hear.
You're much loved. Could this all be a game the Democrats are playing with us? We'd love to do all the things the vast majority of citizens want, but Manchin and Sinema won't let us. That's a quote. The Dems can say they're for the people, but just keep doing the same old thing that serve the same wealthy donors who fund both major parties. Alan, could this all be a game?
Yeah, well, it is a game because we know that the Democrats are now at 50-50 in the Senate. And we know that they need Manchin. Okay, now Manchin starts to act like a proper Democrat in a Republican state, and you're going to find there are two Republicans there. That's what they have to worry about. So they have to condemn him, but at the same time, they can't go too far in going after him.
I agree with that, but, you know, the idea that there isn't a bridge or an electric car in West Virginia— or that West Virginia, if you go and you talk to the local mayors or you speak to the governor there, that there's not an appetite for significant investment in their infrastructure, I just don't think that that's the case. I believe that he has to continue to pander to his right, and certainly he has a Republican base and he has a Democratic and a moderate base there. But this idea of continuing to cling on to the hopes that the people that are on the other side of the aisle are going to come along is just absurd. I think you got
to agree with that.
You got to get back to old-fashioned politics, which means you take out the lipstick, you put it on the pig, and it's it's bacon for everybody.
But there you go.
Back to the cardiology soundtrack. Go ahead.
That would be tofu bacon for you, David.
Yes.
I do want to point out the outsized political influence of the tiny state of West Virginia, which has been dependent on the dying coal industry for decades. That, you know, West Virginia Democrats is a major reason why we've not seen much needed progress on climate change, because of the concern of Democrats in West Virginia that if you adopt laws and regulations that drive down greenhouse gas emissions, it was going to interfere with the growth of the coal industry. You take a step back, that's kind of stunning, right? The political fortunes of Democrats in the tiny state of West Virginia is a significant reason why we had wildfires out west, why people are dying of heat death, why we have sea level rise, why we have intense hurricanes. It's just continuing the tradition of nonsensical politics that is now illustrated in the form of Joe Manchin, that one guy from West Virginia is standing in the way of so much progress on climate change and on so many contemporary issues.
So what do you do about it? So what do you do about it, Judith?
I don't have a solution because Manchin has publicly said, what are you going to do, primary me? You're going to elect a Republican? I mean, I think this is where, you know, Joe Biden says that he has these deep roots in the Senate. And I think this is where Biden has to have Manchin over for lunch, like every Tuesday, and find a way to convince him. However, just a few days ago, speaking in Tulsa on voting rights, Biden pretty much publicly called out Manchin and Sinema for acting more like Republicans. Mm. That's one approach, but I think that's going to increase Manchin's popularity in West Virginia.
I don't get to say this to panelists very often, but Aaron, you were just in West Virginia. Any thought on any perspective on this?
Yeah, some of my cousin-in-laws, I guess you would say, I live in West Virginia, and I was actually talking to them about
He couldn't have made that any more distant if he tried.
You know what? I can because technically they are my step cousin-in-laws.
I know husbands that try to not acknowledge that they're family, but here you go saying they're my cousin-in-laws.
I think fifth cousin-in-law.
Fifth cousin-in-law once removed.
Go ahead.
But I was actually talking to them about that. So there's 14,000 coal jobs
cousin-in-laws?
In West Virginia. No. 14,000 coal jobs in West Virginia. That's been on the decline for decades. The rise technology like strip mining and lower cost alternatives like natural gas has really been what's decimated the coal industry in the United States in general and West Virginia specifically. But there's this – I think what's happening is that people are clinging to a way of life that is disappearing. Right.
That's correct.
There's the pride and the tradition that comes from, you know, hard labor that produced an energy source for the United States for most of the 20th century. And to see that slowly erode and to see the absence of federal support programs that provides any type of assistance for these workers is abysmal. And, you know, what Joe Manchin should be doing is saying, like, listen, West Virginians, this bill has, you know, job training for, you know, renewable energy or in, you know, these other sectors. So, yeah, we need to adopt and, you know, just say bye to an industry that is dirty, creates a lot of health hazards for its workers and move on. But it's still very deep-rooted in West Virginia.
I don't have any cousin-in-laws in West Virginia, but I just want to add that.
Not knowingly,
right. You know, the Biden administration has made a very serious proposal on replacing those coal jobs, and it's viable. It is closing old gas and oil wells that are belching methane into the atmosphere, and which the oil and gas companies did not properly cap. These are equivalent jobs, same wage scale, same skill set. And the Biden administration is offering this in so many of the fossil fuel states. And the local legislators are pretty slow to embrace that. So that's what really makes me question Joe Manchin and the Republicans from Wyoming and Texas who say that they don't want to embrace solutions to the climate crisis because they're worried about local jobs. Well, here they have an option of transitioning. It's a just transition to jobs. I think it's masterful. It's good for the environment and people maintain, you know, good wage jobs, but you don't hear a whole lot about this from Joe Manchin.
Well, I think you both make great points. Look, the reality is I come from a mill town and I understand the pride that the local community, I mean, the mill town is fed, you know, and nurtured, had nurtured my community throughout my childhood. And to see In the 80s and again in the late 80s, to see all those mills shut down and disappear down south, that had an impact in our local community. But we had no leadership that was pointing us in the direction of the future. And, you know, if you're going to say anything about Joe Manchin, it's that he's failed, along with other leaders, to really, you know, give people hope and get them to see that there is other possibilities by which they could define their future, other industries that would help them to define their future. So that's a failing there. The other problem, though, is that you had a guy who all of a sudden came onto the scene and grasped the most powerful podium on planet Earth, promising those people that somehow we're going back to coal. And they believed him because that's what people want to do. They want to believe that somehow there's going to be that resurgence. And so I think there is a challenge for the Biden administration coming along and trying to convince these states that have always had, that have always clung to these industries to all of a sudden abandon them and try something different. That's the kind of thing that needed to happen all along the way to this point.
A couple of letters here for Aaron. Karen says, I don't know if I would be included in jobs numbers, but I've been getting unemployment because I've been depending on rentals in my home through Airbnb and am now iffy about setting up rentals again until I am more confident that anyone who could come to my house would be vaccinated and that I would not be instrumental in spreading the virus.
Yeah, that's...
In the leisure industry. She's right. In the leisure industry.
Hospitality.
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 Yes. Sorry.
Okay, no leisure there.
No.
Beryl says, I think we should be satisfied with the gain in jobs. A much more important issue is the critically serious crisis in California regarding water and the drought. That is going to affect everyone who eats, who works. The fish, the forest, the wildlife, it will dramatically reduce up to 25% of our food supply. Wildfires could be 10 times worse than last year. It is going to bring climate change into even greater focus. The only issue we really have to face is global warming and climate change. Everything else is dependent upon that. Judith, we have 45 seconds. Cue you.
Yeah, I mean, that is an excellent point. It's quite the crisis in California. And remember, all the carbon and greenhouse gas emissions released into the atmosphere today last for decades, if not centuries, some of them. So we are way behind schedule in driving down greenhouse gas emissions, and the climate crisis is here. Buckle up. It's going to be really terrible in California with both drought and wildfires.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll return for our final go-around with our wonderful panel. We welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back. All right, so we have many letters, a lot on, well, just about everything, but on unemployment and many on Joe Manchin. So we'll get to those. Deborah wants, Joni says, okay, before Democrat, quote unquote, Joe Manchin and Republican Shelley Moore Capito, is that correct? West Virginia's U.S. senators were two Democrats, Robert Byrd and my distant cousin, Jay Rockefeller. That time was not that long ago. So what changed to make West Virginia a guaranteed Republican Senate candidate win if Joe Manchin is not there?
We were just talking
about this during the break.
Well, there's just a number of explanations as to what's transpired all across the United States, and people will credit Trump for coming along and converting a lot of these people. But that infrastructure was already built, and it was built by Rush Limbaugh. I don't know how many of you have ever traveled across the country in a car, but I find myself in towns where I couldn't get an FM station. I couldn't find a strong AM station. But you can always find Rush Limbaugh. And so he was there planting the seeds long before some of these other high-profile politicians have come along. And so what you're seeing that's happened in West Virginia is the same thing that you've seen happen in Pennsylvania and all across the Rust Belt.
Deborah writes, why is no one talking about water being traded as a commodity on the stock exchange?
Because it can. I mean, we're trading Dogecoin in different markets. Nothing surprises me.
Rick says, I'm sure West Virginia has many mountaintop sites that would be suitable for wind power as they already have been leveled by the coal industry.
Lots of cousins and mountaintops in West Virginia.
And lots of windmills. We passed a bunch of windmills through our drive there.
Well, that's Judith. Where the jobs are. Yeah, that's where the jobs are. The highest increase in jobs is solar and wind. And it certainly can be used in West Virginia, and it's happening. I mean, on a certain level, the market is kind of ignoring the political winds of the day and massive, massive new investments in wind and solar, thank goodness, and divestment from fossil fuel.
Patrick writes, I don't understand why the infrastructure bill isn't promoted as hardware plus software. Anyone who buys a computer understands that it needs software and hardware to operate. The hardware is the bridges and tunnels and airports and internet, and the software is people and education and childcare and access to what's needed for people to be able to go to work and make a living and support the country.
That's actually brilliant.
Yeah.
Give that man a job with the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah. Patrick, all the news stand releases. In line. Kenneth,
I don't think people get it. I mean, the panel has been brilliant this morning in saying these basic conceptual beliefs die hard whether they're, you know, mountaintops or mining or, you know, mills that have been vacant for a long time. You know, a lot of people don't think about these things, and they just stay with it. And I get it.
John says, so where the bleep, and he just uses the word bleep, are all of the laws that were going to codify the norms and customs that were blatantly violated from 2017 to 2020? Has anything been done to rein in the abuses we saw during the last administration?
You actually need the other side of the House, the one that's currently occupied by all of the Republicans, to come on board to actually pass legislation, to draft and pass.
We go to Kenneth, who says, I think part of the unemployment issue is the potential is that potential employees have the upper hand and employers aren't willing to meet their demands. I've read an interview of a restaurant owner complaining that the first thing potential employees ask is, what are the wages? A worker can just walk across the street to the next help wanted sign and ask the same question. If employers are willing to budge, their problems will persist. Then we go to this question for Aaron about inflation. George says, apparently, at least some of the sources of rising inflation are due to the irregular economic situation in 2020 caused by the epidemic. Namely, prices fell and the current inflation estimates are based on anonymously, low reference prices. Is it not possible to calculate a different inflation rate based on the prices that obtained in 2019 that would give a more realistic estimate of the current inflation? Would it not? Has this been done?
Yes, the San Francisco Federal Reserve has a separate inflation measure that breaks it out between COVID-sensitive prices and COVID-insensitive prices. So COVID-sensitive prices would be things like food and beverage outside of the home, hotel rooms, air flights, and so on, the prices that were severely impacted. And then there's all of the other prices that were not really impacted by COVID. And what you see is a huge divergence. There's a huge spike in the prices for COVID-sensitive goods and services and, you know, pretty much no change in the inflation rate for COVID-insensitive products. So economists do measure this. That's really getting into the weeds of how inflation's calculated. But the story is the same. Yeah, we're seeing a little bit of inflationary pressure because we're trying to reboot a $20 trillion economy that's been shut down for a year in a couple months. There's going to be price pressures, and they're going to be temporary.
All right. We are quickly running out of time, only have about 10 minutes or so. So let's go to the Arctic drilling story. We touched on this earlier in the week, but I am interested in Judith's take on this as we look to this story and we know a little bit more than we did the first time we discussed it. Joe Biden aims to end Arctic drilling. A Trump-era law, however, could foil his plans. The administration suspended leases that were auctioned in the waning days of the Trump White House. However, a 2017 law requires another sale. So, Judith, what does that mean for the future for Anwar?
Well, it's a little bit of a curveball, but it's manageable. So, you know, this was a slippery move by the fossil fuel industry and their allies in the Republican Party, who adopted a law saying that the federal government must issue leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the only way to avoid that is to pass another bill in Congress, not requiring this. Now, a standalone bill is not going to pass in this divided Congress. However, you can attach it to budget bills. You can insert it during budget reconciliation. You know, it's not transparent. It's not good government. It happens every day in Washington. So, you know, if Biden truly wants to stop drilling in the Arctic, which I believe he does, I think there's a way to maneuver around this, and I hope he does that. This comes in the shadow of the International Energy Association, a very moderate body, issuing a report recently saying that all fossil fuel infrastructure, all oil and gas drilling has to stop. if there's a fighting chance of averting the worst impacts of climate change. This is a very moderate body. You know, this is not a Greenpeace report. So that really grabbed a lot of attention in Washington. Unfortunately, this moderate body said, but don't worry about the future of the fossil fuel industry because they're shifting to plastic production. Thanks a lot, guys. But when you have the International Energy Association saying stop all fossil fuel development, that is very significant. It certainly affects ANWR, but also here in New York, we have to stop building gas pipelines. We have to stop bringing power plants back online using fossil fuels to promote Bitcoin mining, for instance, which is happening in the Finger Lakes today. The New York State Legislature is about to adjourn next week. They're not poised to pass important climate change legislation. You know, you've got the big national and international issues, but you also have to kind of shorten the frame and look at what is happening in New York State government, Massachusetts government, et cetera, local governments to avert the climate crisis. It's not just Washington. I am fairly confident that the Biden administration will find a way around this little landmine that the Trump administration left for them, but much, much work to do.
Anybody else on that? All right. Hearing none, we go back to this story. You know, this has turned out to be a fairly major story, and it has dropped off our radar each day, and I haven't gotten to it, and now it's picked up enough steam that it's becoming a thing. The emails of Anthony Fauci. So the story was on Tuesday, the Washington Post, using a Freedom of Information request, went in and got emails that Anthony Fauci had written during the early days of COVID. And so we're looking at February, March, April of 2020. Now, BuzzFeed also published some of these. The U.S.'s top infectious disease experts' emails are now obtained. The disclosures gave conservatives who have long questioned Fauci's stewardship of the coronavirus response something to latch onto beyond shifts in his public comments. They argue that these private emails show Fauci wasn't forthcoming or curious enough when he cast doubt about the Wuhan lab leak theory and argued for a more cautious COVID response than President Donald Trump. The emails have been cited all over conservative media, with commentators often labeling them smoking guns, and GOP lawmakers, including the main Fauci enemy, Rand Paul, re-upping their calls for Fauci to be relieved of his duties. But what's actually in the emails, and how does it square with everything else we know? And then the Washington Post takes a look at that, basically throwing cold water on all of these conspiracy theories.
That's the ecosystem for the conservative and Republican Party today, right? With all the issues that we have to discuss, whether those issues involve the economy, whether those issues involve our environment, this is what they're so fascinated by. And I have to tell you that usually when I see human beings that had like a perm, I feel bad for the human. But when it comes to Rand Paul, I feel bad for the perm, you know, that it has to sit on top of that mess. Rand Paul, you just happen to catch me on a Rand Paul, just him and his dad bother me. But, you know, this is what they're vacillating over, the Fauci emails. And of course, we're talking about February 2020. When exactly. No one really knew much about anything, and all of the learning that we've learned have come based upon exactly. A lot of experiences. And so for this party that didn't trust science and continue to not believe in science to now question the person who did is just laughable.
Alan, we have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, here's the deal. They ran it up the flagpole. Nobody saluted. Goodbye.
There you go. we'll end there, everyone. My thanks to our terrific panel this morning. Alan, thank you so much. Judith, be well. And Aaron and David, wonderful to have you in the studio as always. Have a gorgeous weekend. We will be back with a Congressional Corner right after this.